I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Thomas Jones. My guest today is Mary Wellesley, the author of Hidden Hands, The Lives of Manuscripts and Their Makers, and the presenter with Irina Dumitrescu of several Close Readings podcast series for the LRB on medieval women, medieval beginnings, and currently medieval humour. The latest episode of that on Old English Riddles is out now. But today, Mary and I will be discussing her piece in the current issue of the LRB, a review of Mother Tongue, The Surprising History of Women's Words by Jenny Nuttall. So, hello, Mary, and thank you very much for talking with me today.
Hi, Tom. It's so nice to be here.
Wendy Doniger, reviewing a translation of the Mahabharata for the LRB a few years ago, observed that English, unlike Sanskrit, lacks precise sexual terms that are neither obscene nor medical. But as Jenny Nuttall's book makes clear, Mary, that wasn't always the case, was it?
Yes, it's one of the things that's really wonderful about this book is this very rich history of a terminology for particularly female anatomy and other aspects of kind of female experience, some of which have survived in modern English, some have changed, and some have just completely disappeared for reasons that are somewhat obscure.
And you begin your piece talking about different words for women's genitals. I mean, even the word genitals is one of these words, isn't it? That's sort of one of these Latin words that's been introduced as a way to talk about things without using English, as it were.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the things that Nuttall talks about, is how much of this vocabulary is very kind of overtly medicalized and Latinate and reflects the influence of, I mean, this is a bit of a simplification, but basically as women's medicine and specifically kind of childbirth, midwifery, gynecology became increasingly the preserve of male medical doctors rather than kind of community midwives, as it would always have been up to that point in around the 17th century, you have the proliferation of this kind of terminology that is very Latinate and sort of prosaic and strange. I mean, that word genitals, I always find it so odd that it's in the plural, like as though there are several. But English is wonderfully rich, actually. And one of the words that I start the piece by talking about is this wonderful old English word, quitha. And in the piece, I say that I had told my best female friends about this, and they said it sounded like a lovely village in rural Wales, which, you know, felt kind of apt to us.
And then, but then you talk about sort of the opposite of that in some ways. So you have a word like quitha, and the opposite of that perhaps is vagina, which you talk about how much you dislike as a word, or it's the fact that it means scabbard in Latin, which seems to be very much a male point of view.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is really great about this book is the way in which she's constantly holding in tension terminology that appears possibly to be kind of male-derived or male-authored and female-authored terminology. And that's really wonderful to hear the kind of what we think might be the voices of women from the past. There was a wonderful book written by a midwife that I'd never even heard of. And it's just rather a kind of striking literary survival. And it has all sorts of wonderful observations about female sexual health. And it was just a great delight for me to come across those. So this wonderful book called The Midwife's Book, written by Jane Sharp in 1671. And I looked up Jane Sharp, and we know basically nothing about her that doesn't come from the text. But we know she was a midwife of some 30 years experience. And she has this wonderful description of the clitoris, where she says it is the chief pleasure of love's delight. And it's just so great to hear such kind of unabashed female authored discussion of female sexuality in the pre-modern period. And I think that we have this idea because our sense of the past is so often filtered through the 19th century, right? We tend to kind of look back at the past through that, and we tend to therefore project kind of Victorian social mores and Victorian values onto the pre-modern period. But actually, that's often really misleading, because certainly in my reading of medieval texts, I often find a much more kind of liberated and unabashed attitude towards sexuality or bodies or scatological themes or all kinds of stuff that is a real taboo for us today.
I mean, one example of that, you've talked about this with Irina on your podcast with her about medieval humour, that, and you mentioned in this piece as well, that the way that Chaucer was bowdlerized in the 19th century, although not by the bowdlers who produced the family Shakespeare, as they called it, in the early 19th century, but a similar thing was done to Chaucer, right? And you talk about it in this piece, that it was cleaned up and depilated even.
Well, exactly. There's this wonderful version, or a Georgian version, of Chaucer's Miller's Tale, which listeners might remember is this kind of wonderful story of hijinks in which bums are put into windows and there's a kiss to what is meant to be a woman's face and actually turns out to be her bum, or we're not quite sure. Listeners who are really interested in this should listen to my podcast with Irina, because we talk about this at great length. But there's this kind of Chaucer's description of this woman's, I suppose you would say vulva, but it might be her bum. It's not really clear. It says that she has a beard that he doesn't expect in the darkness. And it says it is all rough and long-haired. So rough and long-haired. And in this Georgian version, this becomes rougher than the down on ladies' cheeks. So it's a wonderful revision, piece of strange revisionism, actually, because there's something so kind of earthy about Chaucer's version, which is something that we see in a lot of medieval texts.
I mean, that whole way of talking about the cheeks, I mean, it makes you raise the question of, well, which cheeks are you talking about? But maybe that's not the spirit in which the revised version is meant to be read.
Well, you're right. Maybe it is meant to be, there's meant to be a sort of duality there, that young ladies might perhaps assume that it is the cheeks of the face, and those of a fallen mind might think of other cheeks. Again, something that Irina and I discuss in the most recent podcast, talking about the Old English riddles, this idea of, you know, how innuendo can work on these sort of multiple levels, and the humour can be layered in all kinds of different ways.
But is that, I mean, this question of things which are male authored and female authored, I mean, is that an aspect of this as well? I mean, something that I'm trying to get to this, but not quite sure how to get my Latin dictionary into it.
I love it when a man says that.
Oh dear! But going back to my Latin dictionary, as I often do, one of the words I looked up was pubes, that the sort of pubic hair, and the primary meaning of the Latin word pubes is rather delightfully pubes, that it's the signs of puberty, the growth of hair, etc. But apparently, it's also used by Virgil to mean, as the dictionary puts it, the pudenda, which of course is a Latin word meaning things to be ashamed of. And even using the Latin is sort of performing that shame as it's describing it. And so much of the modern language about sex and about anatomy, and so in terms of what's considered acceptable, what's considered obscene, and all the different ways of talking around the subject, seems to carry that burden of shame. But there was less shame about private parts in the Middle Ages, or is that wishful thinking?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously we should be wary of too broad brush a generalisation, but I think certainly my reading of the text that I have read seems to be, there seems to be much less shame, and Nuttall's book talks a lot about particularly medical manuals and the ways in which women's health is talked about in medical manuals in a way that does seem often much less sort of anxious about what are fundamentally just kind of natural bodily processes. So I was chatting to somebody last week about this piece, and she says that she lives on the border of England and Wales, and she's got teenage kids. And she says that her children's friends, who are Welsh speakers, tell her, and I thought this was completely fascinating, that there isn't much sort of vocabulary for sexy talk in Welsh, partially because in the kind of end of the 18th, 19th century, you know, Methodism was so strong in Wales, and it very much kind of took over from my understanding, it seems to have taken over the Welsh language and sort of cleansed it. Which is ironic because there's some really amazing, there's particularly some poetry by a 15th century Welsh poet whose name I will certainly butcher because I don't have any Welsh, but she was called Hwefel Mechain, and she wrote an ode to the vagina. So this kind of incredible, very funny, very unabashed description of, you know, female anatomy and the joys of sex and pleasure. But yet, ironically, because Welsh was so controlled by the religious forces of Methodism in the 19th century, her work was not even studied really until really incredibly late, right at the very end of the 20th century, she sort of began to be rediscovered. But in spite of this, in spite of the fact that ironically there is this very rich tradition of Welsh verse about sexual behaviour, apparently modern Welsh doesn't really have the same kind of vocabulary. And this woman who I was talking to said that her children's teenage friends say that in Welsh, what the kind of vocabulary that all the teenagers use is a sort of farming terminology. So they talk about, you know, ploughing the furrow or whatever, which I thought was such a fascinating example of how you reach away from the sort of strictures of language and you let it, and you find kind of flexibility in all kinds of new places, which I just thought was sort of fascinating. And I love the idea that we might be able to kind of open up our own terminology in English and be a little less repressed by these Latinate associations.
Indeed. Well, I mean, that question of farmland, I mean, that does take us back to the Heywood of the Dale, which is the expression which is at the top of the piece. And certainly when I saw that phrase taken out of context, I thought, well, my first thought was, who is that? Is that Hereward the Wake's less famous cousin? But no. So what is the, who or what is the Heywood of the Dale?
The Heywood of the Dale. Well, that is a term for the clitoris. And we find it's a medieval term. And it says that it's the Heywood of the corp, as in the body's dale. So the body's valley in this analogy being the vulva, and then the Heywood being the clitoris. And what's so wonderful is this idea of the clitoris as kind of the overseer. And I thought, right, well, how do I really sort of explain this? So I went and looked up Heywood in the OED, and it says, an officer of a manor, township or parish, having charge of the fences and enclosures, especially to keep cattle from breaking through from the common into enclosed fields. And I just love the idea that you know, the clitoris, this sort of seat of pleasure, is the overseer protecting this dale from encroachment, from lumbering cattle.
I mean, one of the odd things about the word clitoris that's derived from Greek, but people don't not quite sure how it's derived from Greek, that maybe it's connected to kleo, which means close. So maybe it's the idea of it's a sort of lock, which is perhaps connected to that, or the idea that it's a hill, which again is sort of connected. But it's strange that this word, which appeared in English, as you say, in the 17th century, and replacing these earlier words, and in many ways these better words.
Yes, much better words. But also what's great about Nuttall's book is that she's clearly interested in the pre-modern history of the English language, but she also is prepared to sort of look at contemporary slang, and she has some really great examples of slang, many of which feel a lot more delightful than clitoris, which, a bit like this Latinate terminology, feels kind of clunky and strange to say. And, you know, perhaps if only we could go back to thinking of it as the Hayward of the Dale.
Yeah, although, and some of the, I mean, the modern slang, which, as you suggest, you know, as you say in the piece, that you hazard that some of them were invented by men, that little man in the boat, bean, pearl, licorice, all sorts. I mean, the food analogies are quite interesting. That, I mean, that my, you're talking about these children growing up speaking English and Welsh, that my children speak Italian as well as English, and that the Italian terms, when talking to children, that girls have a patatina, a little potato, and boys have a pisello, a pea. And clearly not in the Middle Ages, because there was no such thing in Europe as a potato. So I don't know at what point the Italians started talking about la patatina, but the...
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Yeah, why is it that we... I don't know. I think also sometimes when we're using the terminology of animals, sometimes I think perhaps, you know, food or agriculture or the animal world, these are all spaces and places and things that we feel we have mastery and dominion over. And therefore, we feel embarrassed by this part of the body that is so full of taboo and shame, that somehow it sort of makes it easier to talk about it if it's nothing more important than a potato, or nothing more important than a pea, right? Or a chickpea or a bean or whatever. Somehow these are things that can be kind of cooked and eaten and, you know, destroyed perhaps.
Yeah, well, I mean, that question, that, again, going back to my 1960s Latin dictionary, but the that vulva, which appears as an alternative spelling of vulva, meaning first, any covering husk or shell, and two, the womb, especially a sow's womb, a favourite delicacy among the Romans, for which the dictionary cites Horace as the source for that, which seems really quite disturbing. If we're worried about the ways we think and talk about these parts of the body, maybe we're not as bad as the Romans were. Moving swiftly on. and a lot of these Latin words or Greek words or words derived from Latin, some of them came into English in the 18th, 19th century, but a lot of them seem to have arrived in the 17th century. And that's also when you say that the term period started being used for menstruation.
Yes, this was one of my favourite bits of this book, was the terminology for menstruation. And as Nuttall points out, you know, period is this kind of euphemistic word which is suggesting a period of time. And we have this in the Old English as well, that, you know, the word for menstruation can basically be kind of months or some kind of terminology sort of related to that. But then there's also a whole load of other terminology which is much more sort of descriptive. So we have flusa, which is related to the Latin flux, and renning in Middle English, literally meaning running. But I think the best of all is flowers, which is a word you find in lots of vernacular European languages, you know, the equivalent of flowers, referring to menstruation. There's a very interesting kind of collection of medical texts, which has a really complicated textual history, but is known as the Trotula. So this is a 12th century collection of medical recipes with a long section on specifically women's health and women's medicine, attributed to Trota of Salerno, this female doctor from Italy. And this text was very widely circulated and translated into about 22 languages. And in 14 of those translations, the word flowers, or the vernacular equivalent, is used for the Latin word menses, obviously meaning months. And it's something kind of wonderful about this, because in the text it says, just as trees can't bear fruit without first blossoming, so women cannot bear children without first having their flowers. And of course, you know, today we might sort of slightly balk at this idea that, you know, a woman's entire medical purpose is to have children. Nonetheless, there's something wonderful about how it feels a much more liberated way of thinking about menstruation, which is something that is still today so bound up with taboo and shame. You know, Nuttall talks about the fact that if you want to go and buy a tampon in a shop today, you're probably going to find it in a section of the shop, you know, labeled, you know, sanitary protection or feminine hygiene, as though menstruation is somehow unhygienic or insanitary. When, of course, you know, the endometrium, the lining of the womb that is being shed in the process of menstruation, is something so pure that it can harbor human life. And there was a, there's a wonderful book written by a man called Thomas Reynald called The Woman's Book, in which he says that menstrual blood is pure and wholesome. It's a 16th century text. And so I think, you know, it's a wonderful reminder to us that we need to kind of slough off some of these more ridiculous associations and perhaps try to reconnect with something of our the way in which our pre-modern ancestors thought about this perfectly natural, normal bodily process.
Yeah, I mean, it's like then there used to be those, maybe there still are, those TV ads for, trying to find the right word for them, sanitary products. No, not they, but sanitary pads, as they that was known. Where they but they'd pour on this like really chemical-looking blue liquid to show how absorbent they are. That it all has to be, you know, have this clear, transparent blue chemical liquid to advertise the absorbency. That, I mean, it's as far from blood and as it can be, really, that which is all part of that same.
Yeah, we're so squeamish. Yeah, we couldn't possibly see menstrual blood on TV. I think I read something a while ago about the popular TV American TV show CSI, looking at the number of instances where different bodily fluids appear on screen. And although semen appears repeatedly in practically every episode, you know, menstrual blood is something that you basically never see. Feces is something that you basically never see. You know, it's so interesting that certain kinds of bodily effusion, we don't mind seeing, and we're kind of fixated on. But there are other kinds that we find to be extremely shameful.
I mean, it's not only about the language and the words that Jenny Nuttall looks at in the book. It's not only about sex and anatomy, is it? I mean, she looks at different kinds of work and things like that as well, that it isn't.
Yes, it's a very wide-ranging book, and I shouldn't advertise it as one that is solely about sex and bodily function. It's just that those were the parts that really fascinated me, because it was something that I knew so little about and I hadn't really read very much historical analysis of.
I mean, you've already mentioned a few minutes ago about the way that our view of the Middle Ages is inflected through the 19th century. And some of these words, which, I mean, if someone had, you know, asked me when I thought the word housework came from, I don't know, I'd have guessed a lot earlier than the 19th century.
Yes, I think there has been some work, Barbara Hannawalt, looking at coroner's reports from the Middle Ages, and looking at basically where men and women die. And in peasant communities, generally speaking, to make a large generalization, men die if they die, and it comes up in a coroner's record, they die outside of the home, and women are more likely to die by some kind of accident in and around the home. So there is a rough distinction, but I think the Industrial Revolution obviously really separated the world of work and the world of the home. And we start to have, you know, and here I'm straying out of into territory I don't know so well, but the sort of fetishization of the home, and particularly the woman's place within the home, the kind of angel of the home, is very much a sort of construct of the 19th century and a sort of byproduct of industrialization and that separation of the kind of public and the private realm.
The way in which words became. Words came to have a much more fixed gender, that as you talk about in the piece, that neither girl nor man were gendered when they were first used in English.
Yes, exactly. So the word man, mon in Old English, you know, the first time that's quoted in the OED is actually talking about a man, mon, which meant a human being with heavy periods. So as we record, the Scottish government has just passed a law that is outlawing all kinds of hate speech, and the issue of what a woman is in the law is a really, really fraught and complicated one. And to some degree, I find it kind of comforting that if we leapfrog back, we find a much more nuanced and loose notion of what all this terminology means.
That a man was any person and a girl was any young person.
Exactly.
Another thing that you say about that in the piece is that this question of ungendered nouns being given a male pronoun, that the assumption that the reader, the listener, the man on the Clapham omnibus, whoever, is a man, this assumption that that if you have a person who of indeterminate gender, then let's give them a male pronoun. And that began really quite recently. That was an early 19th century thing.
Yeah, and I suppose it's of a piece with attempts to sort of regulate language, right, in this kind of era of lexicography and the regularization of language, you know, often trying to make the English language fit models of Latin, you know. So it's in this period that you have this idea of the split infinitive being something that you can't possibly have in English, and that's simply because the infinitive is one word in Latin. This idea that we've got to somehow sort of press English into the sort of awkward straitjacket of Latin grammatical structures. You know, medieval language is much more riotous and spontaneous and kind of and refuses to sit in these neat categories. You know, there is no fixed spelling, and words are used in this often wonderfully anarchic way.
If you enjoy the LRB podcast, you might also enjoy the We Society podcast from the Academy of Social Sciences. In each episode, Will Hutton untangles the grand challenges we face as a society, looking at them from a social science perspective. Will has gathered some of the UK's most groundbreaking and influential social scientists to ask how their research could help solve some of the country's and the world's most pressing problems. In Season 5, the We Society tackles Britain's ailing high streets, bankrupt councils, and the continued lack of disability inclusion, among other important topics. So, if you want to hear research-led insights and solutions and a great conversation, listen and subscribe to the We Society on all podcast platforms. The division of labour and the idea of the man going out to work and being paid for it and the woman staying at home and working and not being paid for it. Was this division of labour reflected in language and in the names for different kinds of job, different kinds of occupation?
No, certainly not. I mean, I think we sort of tend to think of women's work as being a sort of something that only happened in the 20th century, when actually women went out to work quite a bit before then. But Nuttall quotes some lovely vocabulary related to women's occupations. So, you know, the apple wife, the egg wife, the oyster wife, the tripe wife. Perhaps my favourite is the book woman.
And wife, presumably meaning woman, not meaning married person, yeah.
Exactly. Huif in Old English just means woman. But then there's also, she also quotes this wonderful word that's used in the Paston letters by Margaret Paston, who listeners may have heard of or come across, who was this woman from 15th century Norfolk who wrote these amazing, I mean, it's huge trove of letters survive between four generations of a family in the kind of from the mid to late 15th century. And what's so striking is the way that the sort of women's lives come out in these letters. And you get this really striking picture of the women being left behind to run these estates while the men go off to London. And I think several generations of them were lawyers, and they were at the Inns of Court. And Margaret writes these kind of wonderful letters saying, you know, oh, and when you come back from London, please could you bring half a pound of almonds, half a pound of sugar, some cloth for the children's gowns, two or three short pole axes, and then some other weaponry. But we have this kind of wonderful sense of, you know, there she is being left behind to kind of do, you know, what we would think of as man's work, but while her husband is off in London. And Nuttall quotes this wonderful word that she uses herself, which seems to be her invention, where she talks about herself as a captainess, using this kind of feminine suffix. But it's a wonderful example of how we shouldn't take the model of the 19th century and automatically assume that women in the Middle Ages were just sitting at home doing their embroidery.
I mean, you do have these sort of terrible expressions that you still hear people using now, like lady doctor. I was on a bus not that long ago, and there was a child was asking their mother what the bell was for, something like that, and she explained that you pressed it to let the lady bus driver know that you wanted to get off the bus. And it's and it seemed a bit sad, really, that you'd have to refer to the lady bus driver rather than just the bus driver. But maybe not, from the way that you're talking about it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think I talk a little bit in the piece about what it's like to use words with my own children who are still small and learning language. And I, in a funny way, I think I find myself often tripping up the most when I'm talking to my daughter. The other day I was trying to convince her to wear a seatbelt. And I was about to say, but if a policeman saw you, and then I found myself saying, but if a police officer saw you, and thinking how completely deranged I sounded. But yeah, it's kind of interesting that you feel, especially when you're talking to your children, like you feel the power of the words and how much you're defining their experience with the linguistic choices that you're making and how you can tie yourselves up in knots. And you're constantly striving for the right way to describe the world to them.
And that gets to the expression mother tongue, which Jenny Nuttall takes for her title.
Yes, it's a really, I just love that title. And she talks about how this phrase, lingua materna, the mother tongue, was first used in kind of Latin discourse in the sort of 12th century to distinguish the language you learnt at home, impliedly the sort of childish baby talk, from Latin, the language of the learned fathers, of patristic sources. And, you know, clearly it's meant to be a sort of derogatory term. But I feel like it's a very powerful idea because of how the primary carer is vested with this incredible power to describe the world, to teach words, and also how kind of intoxicating it is watching a child learn a word and grasp a word. You know, I've got a one-year-old who's just trying to even make words at all. But I also have a three-year-old who's learning new words all the time. And this morning I made her pancakes and we were talking about the word batter. And she was quite confused about what relationship it had to butter. but, you know, it's just these kind of everyday moments. But it feels like, I mean, in the piece I talk about that scene in the book of Genesis when Adam names the, you know, the fowls of the air and the beasts of the earth. And it's meant to be this sort of great moment of, you know, man's dominion over nature. But, you know, it's the primary carer who's teaching the children how to name the world.
And does Jenny Nuttall write about being a mother in the book?
Yes, a lot. Yeah. It's one of the things that's really delightful is her kind of reflections on her experiences of raising her now teenage daughter, but also in different parts of the book. There's a wonderful bit when she's talking about all the vocabulary to do with nursing, as in caring for a child. She talks about that, the old English word care, or the sort of old English version of the word care. You know, as we discussed earlier, the verb to mother, as in to raise children, specifically the mother raising children, is an invention of the 19th century. So before that, to mother simply meant to be the mother of, so a sort of simple genetic formulation. And one of the things that she talks about is how the etymological origins of nurse do take us all the way back to this idea of the female who nurses, you know, impliedly breastfeeding and the production of milk. But this word care from the Old English carian, which, you know, is to have sorrow or feel concern or feel anxious, she sort of gets at how looking after children is as much the job of the mind as it is the body. And she also talks rather beautifully about how she talks specifically about the term child minder and about how the child minder lends their mind to the project of looking after a child. And there's a very moving bit when she talks about returning after a day of work when her children are very small to pick up her daughter who's kind of nested asleep on the sofa next to the child minder, or sometimes even the child minder's mother, who she also knew. And there are many moments like that in this book that make it so personal and humane and warm and truly a wonderful work of scholarship. The book is so full of these really interesting examples from the history of the language, but also these kind of issues of parenting that Nuttall had obviously come across. And she talks about, you know, parenting her daughter when she was young, and those parts really resonated with me because I've got young children. But she also talked about, you know, some of the trials and tribulations of raising teenagers and how fraught the language that we use becomes with teenagers. And I And I remember thinking, gosh, she sounds so wise. I'd love to reach out to her and borrow her mind in the way that she talks about the great child minders lending their mind. I was really sad to discover while I was finishing the review that she died and I would never get the chance to meet her.
Thank you, Mary, very much.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You can read Mary Wellesley's piece in the latest issue of the LRB, dated 4th of April, along with Mike J on Sleep, Brandon Taylor on Zola, and Hazel V. Carby's winter lecture, Remembering the Future. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourne. The music is by Kieran Brunt. I'm Thomas Jones. Thank you for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.